اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
نهج البلاغة, translated as the peak of eloquence, is a compilation of sermons, letters, and sayings that reflected Imam Ali's profound insights on governance, ethics, spirituality, and social justice. Sayyid Razi's meticulous work in preserving and presenting Imam Ali's words has made Nahj al-Balagha a timeless source of inspiration for scholars, theologians, and seekers of wisdom.
Now, we will go to other narrations from Imam Ali alayhi salam, especially when it comes to the wealth of the of the people that are in power. So, Imam Ali alayhi salam, for example, says, "An-nasu bi umara'ihim ashbahu minhum bi aba'ihim." The riwayat says, it's in Tuhf al-Uqul, page number 208. He says that people are more similar to their leaders than they are to their fathers. Now, this is a kind of a dangerous narration. That means you as a leader of the society, you need to be really careful. Yes, the father and the parents and the family may have an influence, but your influence as a leader is more profound. You who are in a leadership position, however small or however big, note that you are creating an effect into the hearts of the people, so you need to be careful. Or for example, Imam Ali alayhi salam says in another narration, in another sermon of Nahj al-Balagha, he says, لا تصلح الرعية إلا بصلاح الولاة, that citizens will never become good and they will never change except when the leaders and the governors change. So, again, this only emphasizes how we need to be careful about who we choose as leaders, who becomes a leader, and how a leader should be careful about his actions and his duties. And now, especially when we notice that the people notice that the leadership is just enjoying themselves, is just enjoying itself in terms of the material, material way. And at the same time, let's say it is misappropriating funds, misusing funds and all of these things. If the people see this, then they will become like that. And this will be the start of the destruction of the society. So, this sukrun ni'mah, to become drunk because of the blessings, one of the areas where it can be damaging is when it affects the leadership and the people that are in authority, and that in turn can affect the whole society and cause destruction. And therefore, we need to be very careful as people, especially if we have leadership positions, to make sure we live a life of purity and of integrity. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Welcome to the Israel Watch, which has been monitoring recent developments, including the repercussions of the Iranian attack on the entity and the Israeli response, as well as the failure of the aggression on Gaza to undermine the resistance and break the steadfastness of Gazans, in addition to the state of anxiety resulting from the situation the entity faces. I'd like to go ahead and welcome our guest today, Dr. Omar Nashabi, a political analyst, to our show today. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Let's begin today with the Hebrew media, which has focused on the allegations of a Zionist response to the Iranian attack in Isfahan. The enemy's media not only adopted these allegations, but also built on them to warn of a possible Iranian response. Well, Doctor, what is the Zionist objective in promoting these allegations about a response to the Iranian attack in such an unconvincing manner?
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous. I've been following the news since early in the morning, and we're following different media outlets, and there is no evidence of an attack, an Israeli attack on the Iranian soil. There are some information about the coming from Iran about some small drones that are local, that are minimal. Actually, they don't actually create any damage, and they were there. They're used usually for civilian objectives, not for military objectives, the type of drones. These are the preliminary information that just came out. When it comes to the Israeli media sources, well, there's a lot of talk, but there's no evidence, nothing concrete. So it's just petty talk, and it's absolutely puzzling, because usually when you do such a response, you do it in a spectacular way because you want to give this illusion to the settlers and the Israelis.
Well, actually, Doctor, like you're saying, the word you're using here is illusion. Many people have been trying to find a word to this attack. I do want to ask you, do you think these allegations could be an exit for Netanyahu's government from the response crisis that they have been experiencing ever since the Iranian attack?
Well, obviously, I mean, there were so many prime ministers, presidents of allied countries to the Israeli entity have been advising Israel not to respond, and therefore he wants to keep it at a minimum level. But that seems too minimal, and there is no indication that these planes came from the occupied Palestine in the first place. So, I mean, that will backfire against Netanyahu, because it will create more fears. So settlers and Israelis will have more fear, because they will say, oh, this is the response by our military capacity? It is absolutely ridiculous.
Well, Doctor, actually, it's a great time right now to go ahead and add something that's been buzzing everywhere, where, on the other hand, Ben-Gvir saw that the alleged Zionist response to Iran was nothing but a mockery, which raised concerns among the security apparatuses in the entity. Do you believe it was a good idea for Ben-Gvir to comment in the first place?
I think that his comment, yes, it will create damage. They had fear on this television program that he will create damage. Well, the damage has already been done, because, you know, they thought that even if they would, do such, have some news that they attacked Iran, that Iran will react emotionally, or Iran will speed up its response in an emotional and brutal and violent way. Well, they didn't understand how the Iranian system works.
Exactly. He described it as a mockery, and it seems that he became the center of this mockery.
Exactly. And the Iranians do not take things lightly. The Iranians want to actually know all the details about this attack before deciding what to do. And until now, all the information that is available to the Iranians, who have actually, checked out the whole locations there, and who have been, watching any Israeli military move towards Iran. Well, until now, the information is that there is no attack from Israel on Iranian soil. This is, a local thing that was done locally.
Yes.
And it is a repetition of what has been done before, because Iran had been subject to a lot of crimes, that targeted civilian scientists,
exactly.
University
They've
professors.
They've been through exactly a lot, and as a first time of their attack. I believe only one question here. How do you interpret his position as a member of the War Council refusing to attack Iran?
Yes, well, this position, and the position we showed a bit earlier with Ben-Gvir, these two, and the position of Europeans and Americans, pressuring Israel not to respond, these are all indications of the large schism and divisions between the Israelis, and that's a new feature in the confrontation with the Israeli enemy. That has not happened before in previous wars. For the first time, the Israelis have divisions between them. They have divisions and differences with the Americans and with their European allies.
Actually, that you're mentioning the U.S. European, do you believe that that Israel's such a small response was because of the U.S. European pressure?
I think it was a response like that because, you know, Netanyahu said he would respond and that he didn't want to go back on his word.
So he had to do it no matter what.
And he had to do it no matter what. But I think the results will be, you know, I dare to say that they're catastrophic. Because on the Israelis themselves, because
it's such a very
as I
good
said
point,
in the beginning,
doctrine.
You know, the settlers and the Israelis will not believe that the Israeli army and the Israeli military has capacity and the power to defend them from another Iranian attack.
Is Eitan Ben Eliyahu actually proposing a retaliation to Iran in Gaza?
Well, that's what he's saying. I think, and that's again a sign of weakness. I mean, they want to go on and expand the genocide. I mean, and we were looking at this equipment that the Israelis have. They have the most advanced technology and equipment, but they just don't know how to use it.
And Biden today mentioned he's going to be sending over more, correct?
Yeah, well, and Ursula von der Leyen said that she wants to develop the actual European capacity in order to confront, you know, the Iranian danger. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, Iran had responded legitimately to an attack that it was subject to on its embassy in Damascus. It did
just
it.
One of the attacks, I mean, not to mention the previous
but
ones.
But Iran responded in a way that was in line with international law. It targeted military facilities. It gave an early warning, and it was a totally legitimate and proportionate attack. And I think this is outstanding because this shows this political and diplomatic maturity by the Islamic Republic in Iran. And for the first time, it showed this weakness, this unprecedented weakness of the Israeli entity,
that finally,
and the unprecedented divisions within the Israeli community and, and political,
which actually, doctor, like you're mentioning, was something the whole world saw this time. Why do you believe, as we have seen repetitively, why does Israeli army lie and conceal the real losses of the previous Iranian attack?
Well, they wanted to say that, you know, the Iranian attack was insignificant, and that was their objective. And now they're faced with the truth. They have, again, this contributes to more schisms and more differences, and they are completely confused. I mean, they don't know how to deal with this. Although there's one important fact that they know and everybody knows, is that Iran spent a few million dollars on this attack. I mean, these were first generation, drones and planes and cruise missiles. They were not like advanced, the most advanced.
Locally made.
They were locally made, and of course, and the more advanced are also locally made. But these were the old ones, the old models. And that was what Iran spent, and spent a few million dollars, whereas the Israelis spent, according to them, more than $1.35 billion to counter that attack. And in addition to that, what is more valuable that Iran gained, it's Iran actually knows now how the Israelis and what capacity
and
they have.
And as we know, this is a new generation of warfare.
Yes, and they know, the Iranian intelligence and army now know how the Israelis would respond if another attack will occur. So the next attack, and we hope it will never happen, because we hope the Israelis will leave Palestine and give back the land to those who actually own it. But if there will be an upcoming attack, then the Israelis will feel it, and this time they will feel it really hard.
Well, doctor, what is your opinion on some Zionist commentators linking Israel's response to the Iranian attack with the issue of prisoners and the situation in Gaza?
Well, it's absolutely ridiculous. This lady, this person on the screen, doesn't actually understand that they will never get the hostages back if they don't respond to the demands of Hamas and the Islamic Jihad. And that is these are the instructions of the supreme leader in Iran. It is Hamas and Jihad. It is Yahya Sinwar and Abu Khalid al-Dayf and the leadership of Hamas and the Islamic Jihad and the resistance in the field who are fighting a heroic, unprecedented. This is like Greek mythology. Yahya Sinwar and Abu Khalid al-Dayf are fighting with these men from underground for 200 days, whereas the most advanced technology ever in history is being attacking them, is attacking them on a non-stop basis. Not only the Israeli army, the U.S. army, the French army, the British, and the most advanced technology they threw on these people in 360 square kilometers, 85,000 tons of metal and steel, and they've been able to actually continue to resist. These people don't know what they're talking about. They are confronting some of the fiercest fighters ever. And I'm not exaggerating.
Definitely
I'm giving
yes.
scientific information
and this
in the
is
history
why,
of civilization.
Exactly. And this is why these names will go down in history.
Of course, definitely.
Yes. Moving now to the southern Lebanese front opened by Hezbollah in support of Gaza and the resistance and its people, where the strikes received by the occupying army have become more painful. Have we noticed, we have noticed an increase in the frequency of the painful qualitative operations as happened at the military site, as we know, of Aramsha. How do you respond to what is happening?
Well, you know, this video and these statements and the previous video, they are talking about restoring the power of Israel and the capacity of Israel to deter its enemies or to deter us. This is absolutely ridiculous. They've been doing this for 200 days. They've been doing this for 75 years, trying to deter the resistance and trying to think that there is a violent solution by them scaring their neighbors, you know, instilling fear and terror and terrorizing the whole region. That's how Israel can be a safe place, by terrorizing others. That's what they're saying. What is it that the general said in the previous video? He said that we must work on restoring deterrence because it's not working anymore, and Iran dared to do what it wouldn't have dared to do before, and the Palestinians did on October 7 what they wouldn't have dared to do before, and the resistance in northern occupied Palestine is doing what it never dared to do before. Well, I have news that this is going to continue, and this Israeli criminal entity doing a genocide, and the genocide itself is never, ever going to be considered as a deterrent. The resistance will continue as it continued for 75 years. What part of this sentence do the Israelis not understand? It's because they have a criminal mind, and a criminal mind is incapable of thinking otherwise.
Zionist social media reacted strongly to this issue, and here are some sarcastic comments about the absolute victory that Netanyahu spoke of.
Agam, we lost. They returned to these shores. Brothers were killed there. Here, 600 soldiers were killed and their families do not sleep at night. Tal, 133 abducted are suffering in the tunnels, and the residents of Gaza celebrate on the beach. There are no words to describe this. Shahaf, I have a lot of shame from this war. How humiliating and unpatriotic. Nicole, the war is over. We lost. Anne, a complete victory, but it's not ours.
Doctor, very briefly, what are the implications of acknowledging that Hamas, even after more than half a year of aggression, still governs Gaza and has not undermined its authority?
Well, they're saying that Hamas controls Gaza. No, it's not true. The Palestinian people control Gaza, and the Palestinian people support Hamas. That is the right way to say it. It is not that Hamas is actually doing like a despotic regime in Gaza. These people and the people of Gaza had ample all the opportunity to break away from Hamas. They hold on to the resistance and they hold on to the leadership. And Yahya Sinwar and Abu Khalid Al-Dayf are the ones to make a huge breakthrough. And every Israeli will remember these two names.
Definitely. A great way to end off today. I'd like to go ahead and thank Dr. Aman Ashabi, political analyst, for joining us today. It was my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Till next time, salam.
Start. Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
on Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station. I am a Muslim, I am a Muslim. Islamati, Islamati. Allah my Lord, His word Quran, His word Quran. Muhammad, Prophet, Muhammad, Prophet. Praise be upon, praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners from all around the world. Welcome back to a new episode of
Youth Station.
I am Beta.
And this is Mustafa.
Brothers, you know, we're living in a world that everybody is like, okay, I do care about myself. And whenever I don't have any problem, I have nothing to do with other people's problems. Okay, so we are living in a world like that. And at the same time, when we go through the Islamic teachings, we see that you have to be the voice of the oppressed people. And even we have so many narrations and verses in the Holy Quran, and this narration from Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, that you have to be the voice of the oppressed people. And if you're not, you're not a member of our ummah. And so it means that this is one of your absolute responsibility to be the voice of people who are in need. But unfortunately, this is something which is being ignored and being indifferent towards, unfortunately. So what can we do about it?
Yeah, I think, by the way, a big part of it is, you know, and you'll hear this maybe in English, is that collectivism or individualism.
Yeah.
Right? When we talk about different cultures, for example, typically when we talk about Western culture, they focus a lot in individuality, which means that the individual should be successful. The individual, you know, should be independent. For example, you see that, in many Western societies, when you turn 18, you're expected to leave the house.
Yeah.
You're expected to, like, have a job. You're expected to do everything on your own. If you don't, then you're considered a failure. On the opposite side, we have collectivism, like you said, you know, and that's something that's strong among Eastern cultures, not only Islamic. Like, if you go to India or China, a lot of these people are considered, you know, a lot of these considered collectivism.
Yeah.
And the idea behind that is that you work together, you know, that you help each other. If somebody's down, you help them, you know. In fact, in Pakistan, if you said that you want to leave the house at 18, you're going to get slapped, you know, for your dad.
Yeah,
it's like
you're
the complete
the same
opposite.
Too.
So there's this sort of now mixture of these two right now, right, where we're seeing that people are becoming, I would say, individualism creates selfishness, right?
Yeah.
Where people only care about themselves, and that's not good. That's not a good thing.
Yeah, actually, it's a vicious cycle. Selfishness will lead to individualism itself, strengthen this attribute of selfishness in people. And another thing is that because of the impact of Western countries and Western culture on Eastern society and Muslim countries, our youth generation is like, I want to be independent. I want to go out of the home sooner than what I want. And, you know, they're like, I don't want to have children because there are burdens and something like that. You know, they are destroying the meaning and value of family. And I believe it is equal to individualism itself.
There's papers specifically written about how, for example, one of the, by the way, agendas that's out there is reducing world population. They say there's too many people, you know, in the world. The world can't, there aren't enough resources, for example, in the world. So the world's population needs to be reduced. So a big part of that is breaking down the family. And the way you break down the family is you promote individualism and selfishness, right?
Yeah.
That you really only care about yourself. And we're seeing the negative effects of that right now, right? We're seeing it in our own families, I would say. We're seeing, like, when people do those kind of selfish things, we're seeing, for example, divorces are increasing. We're seeing problem with having much more mental disorders. We're seeing so many other issues. That's because of this.
I agree with that. Yeah. Brother, there is another dimension to this topic that, for example, if we want to change the world, we have to start this change from ourselves.
Hmm.
I mean, sometimes people and individuals, specifically a generation, things like that, okay, I have to change myself first. I cannot change the world ambitiously.
Yeah.
So what do you think about it? But let's have your idea after a short break. Stay tuned, dear listeners.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back. This is your station where we're talking about individualism and collectivism. And we get to this point that some people justify and defend their individualism with this excuse that, okay, I have to first change myself. I cannot help other people if I don't have this resource to do that.
Well, it depends, right? I think sometimes that may be correct in the sense there is. I'm not saying it's completely negative, like individualism. There are positive aspects to it. And of course, you have to care about yourself, your own health. I don't know. You know, when you sit on a plane, they tell you, for example, if there's a lack of oxygen, you need to wear that first.
Yeah.
And then you put it on the child, right? Because if you don't do it yourself first, you're not going to be able to help the child either, right? You're going to faint. So there, nobody's denying that, you know, that you don't care about yourself or that you only care about others. I think it's having a right balance between the two.
Yeah.
If, yeah, you do, you should care about yourself. You should take care of yourself. And, but it's in a positive manner, right?
Exactly.
You shouldn't be doing it at the expense of others.
In a selfish way.
Yeah, it shouldn't be that for your own like benefit, like for your own sake, somebody else is being harmed. That's what we're saying. When we're talking about being selfish, it's like we're doing things at the expense of others. You don't want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to cause. And by the way, one of the harms of being selfish individualism in the long run is that it causes you harm.
Yeah.
Right? Because
how come?
Like, think about it. If you're living in a society where people only care about themselves, when you need help, is there someone going to be there for you?
No, for sure. You have only yourself.
And that's what you see in a, you know, I was watching this interview of this guy in America who became homeless, right? And he said that, you know, nobody's helping me. My own family's not helping me. And now he's homeless.
Yeah.
Right? So is that, that's what I'm saying. It can go to a very extreme form. And we need a balance between those
exactly.
two.
Exactly. You know, I saw the same documentary. I think it was about homeless people.
There's so many, by the way, out there.
Yeah. And they were so sad, all of them, because they don't have a family to come back to. And it's like you're cutting your blood line and you don't have anyone in this world. And even in some countries, we have some institutions for lonely people because one of the consequences of this individualism is that you will end up alone. Okay, you don't have anyone to rely on. You don't have any friends. You don't have anyone to rely on whenever you're in trouble. And these are the problems. And human beings are social beings. We cannot cut our connection with other people. It's impossible, I believe. I believe every human being needs solitude sometimes. You have to be alone. You have to think on your life, on your process, what you did up to here, what you were going to do from now on. And these are the points, but it doesn't mean that you have to be selfish. You have to put yourself as the priority in the expense of others.
Right.
And I believe other times that we have to remember the meaning of sacrifice and the meaning of martyrdom. Martyrdom is the most beautiful and complete example of sacrifice.
Right.
And in order to not be deviated to the road of individualism, we have to search throughout the history and see the sacrifices that made for us to be here, to live in peace.
Yep. And, you know, I have a friend who lives in France. You know, I met him when I was living in the United States. And he lives by himself, okay? He hasn't managed to get married. And then he suffered through a lot of depression. He tried to kill himself twice. Okay.
Oh, my God.
Now he's doing much better because he's, you know, he's gotten help and things.
Thank
but God. It's a common problem in those societies, you know, that they're not able to get married. They don't have their... His parents are there. He has sisters, you know, but they're not able to rely on each other, right?
Yeah.
So the harm, I think, is very, very apparent of, like, you know, only caring about yourself. You know, it's going to hurt you, like I said, in the long run. A human being is, like, we're created in a way where we need each other.
Exactly.
Right? Or another example I can give is if you look at Japanese society, it's probably one of the, like, most lonely people in those societies, right?
Yeah.
Did you know that in Japan, like, you can pay someone to be your friend?
Oh my gosh.
Like, that's a job. Like,
that's so sad.
That's a job that's available that, you know, that I could be hired just to talk to someone. Like, they literally pay people just so they can talk to them.
Yeah.
Or accompany them, for example, for dinner or something. That's, what kind of society is that? Is that what we want?
Yeah.
Is that what you want? Like, I mean, I wouldn't mind getting paid to talk to someone, but, you know, on the other hand, it's you know what I'm trying to say, that it's bad.
Yeah, it is too bad. And I believe we have to rebuild these meanings and these values of our life. For example, about friends, I believe that this generation have this problem because we think when we're alone, we are more successful, we are more productive, but this is not true. I believe every educational system should focus on this group work, teamwork. Teamwork is really important to show the people that you need each other in order to be productive, in order to develop.
And by the teamwork that you mentioned, by the way, so in the same societies that promote individualism, you'll find that teamwork is also being emphasized. But where is it being emphasized? In businesses. Okay. Oh. Why? Because they realize that by teamwork, you can, you know, if people work better, they're more productive, they produce more, and therefore they produce more profit for that company.
Yeah, exactly.
So you see that even in those societies that they realize the need to do teamwork. Right? Yeah. I remember when I used to do like job interviews, one of the questions they would ask is, how much experience do you have with teamwork? What do you think of teamwork? You know, what kind of examples? So we're saying what we're saying is we need to broaden this teamwork in the rest of society, in all aspects of society.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
And of course, the result will be positive of that. Of course, if we work together, things will be better. That's the whole. Yeah. That's how societies are formed. So it's only logical.
It is.
Right?
And the logical thing is that we have to go for a short break.
Okay, got it.
Effective teamwork, and that even in the most individualistic countries like Japan, like some Western countries, even at those countries we have this teamwork, specifically in business content, that we need to be productive. And it shows that even if we try to deny the fact that we need each other, we need each other.
By the way, I think one source of like sort of some individualism comes in when we want to go after our desires, right?
Right.
Right? Because a lot of times that's when like other people come in the way, is that I would say, hey, I want to smoke, I want to drink, I want to like, you know, have relationships. And now like, you know, my family's coming in the way.
Exactly.
Right? So we have realized that individualism is really an excuse many times to pursue your own selfish, low desires.
Yeah.
Right? And then that can, by the way, result in a terrible sort of... But the friend that I mentioned, you know, right before the break,
yeah,
right? He's a good example of that. He
exactly.
pursued every pleasure that you can imagine when he was young. And now he's in a situation where he was almost suicidal. He's alone and he's lonely, right? I would tell the youth that, look, do you want to live a lonely life, you know? Is that what you want? You know, do you want to have just superficial relationships or just temporary pleasures? And then once you're older, what's going to happen?
Exactly.
You know? Who's going to be there for you when you're older? Are those friends that you have right now, are they going to be there for you? They're not going to be there for you. So just, you know, having family, having people around you is going to be a big source of happiness, a big source of help for you. You know, it's going to make your life better. Like, I can't emphasize that enough.
And I believe that living in this materialistic world, that most of the people believe that you are a materialistic creature. You have to keep that in mind. You are spiritual, but you have a materialistic dimension. And in order to feed that materialistic dimension, don't sacrifice your spiritual part.
Individuality can be important when you're establishing your relationship with God. That's where you should place value on it.
Yeah.
In your personal worship with God, you know, in your personal obligations towards God, those will impact the rest of, like, you know, people around you as well.
Exactly.
That's where it's important. And I guess we're out of time, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, we're out of time. There is a lot to talk about this topic. But thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. I wish it was helpful for you. And wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you dear youth will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Allah, 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 Allah.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
Questions and answers. In Islamic upbringing,
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And to help us with our questions, we have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Almiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad. It's always nice to be with you. Thanks for coming over.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. It's always nice to be with you as well. Thanks.
All right, so here in IRIB English Radio, it's story time today. And it's been, if you've been following us for a few episodes, we've been talking about using stories to introduce the Ahlul Bayt as role models to our children. And just to recap on what we've been talking about the elements that we have to consider when telling stories, we've said that it's best to keep your sentences small, keep your body language and the tune of your stories in sync with the story, involve the children, let them interact, let them narrate parts of the story, let them make the sounds if they want to. It's okay if they ask you to repeat a story a million times. They'll love it every time. And you should remember to appreciate and acknowledge their understanding, but not by asking them directly. And don't forget that you can always let them act out the story, so it can also be a game for them to play. So today, Brother Miqdad, we're going to ask you to give us a few stories and samples, and we'll be listening with both our ears.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So just to quickly make the point clear that we said that the role of these stories is to strengthen our relationship with the Ahlul Bayt and the children's relationship with the Ahlul Bayt. That the ultimate goal that we want is for them to be, I want to be like Ali alayhi salam, right? Once you've attained that goal, you can kind of relax, because then the path is very easy from then on, right? If a person is going to be doing things because Ali alayhi salam does it, okay, then you made it very simple for them. And so therefore, these stories really helped to do that. So let me try and give an example and demonstrate one story over here, and then we can do even two afterwards. So Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So dear children, here's a story that I want to tell you about a companion called Kumail. Now, quickly, companion, use friend is better, right? Because if you use companion, they're going to ask, what's a companion? Remember what we said, they use words that are easy for children to understand. So children, I'm going to tell you about a friend of Imam Ali who was called Kumail. Now, one night, they were in the mosque in Kufa, when all of a sudden, Imam Ali came to Kumail and grabbed his hands. He grabs his hands and he pulled him towards him and said, let's go. And they started to walk. And Kumail wasn't sure, where were they going? Where was Amirul Mu'mineen taking me? But he just followed, just like a good friend would follow his friend. So he followed Amirul Mu'mineen and they started walking towards the desert. It was dark. It was night. But he wasn't scared, because he knew that he was following his imam. And wherever the imam goes, there must be good there. So he follows the imam. The imam is still holding his hands, and they walk, and they walk, and they walk, until they reach a place where there is nothing there, just sand, and they're all alone. Wow, you can imagine, Kumail is all alone with Imam Ali. And then at one place, Imam Ali sits down, and Kumail also sits down. And then Imam Ali starts looking down. He puts his head down, and he looks down, and suddenly, it's all quiet. And then Imam Ali raises his head and turns to Kumail and says, oh Kumail. And then you know what? He tells Kumail some really, really important things. Do you know what Imam Ali tells Kumail?
Well, I know that you said that we shouldn't let kids on a suspense, but we have to take a break, and I hope the grown-ups can take this break. Let's go for a break, and we'll be back for the rest of the story.
Hey, stop! I got a better game!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry, we're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. In the last few episodes, we've been talking about how to tell stories to children in order to introduce the Ahlul Bayt as their role models. A few minutes ago, Brother Maghdad here was giving us a sample of how to tell stories. Unfortunately, since it's a radio, you can only hear, which was very good. But I also like to say that I noticed how when you were talking about something spooky, you were talking slowly, and it could be seen in your facial expression, and how when you wanted to tell them that it's okay to follow Amir al-Mu'mineen, you were smiling and you were happy. This is something our audience cannot see, and it goes back to the body language. So before the break, you were saying that Imam Ali was just about to tell Kumail something special.
Thank you for mentioning those comments. Yes, so we mentioned before as well, the facial expression is very important. And I'm sure there's you can even do better than what I did, right? We could have made sound for the steps that they were taking whilst they were walking towards the desert, right? We could have made the sound of the wind in the desert, right? Make the introduction very nice, you see. And also, if you notice as well, we talked about how Kumail was following his imam, right? So you don't have to mention anything. It just happens in the story. But you know, those words playing. If you play it 2-3 times, okay? What's in the memory now is that Kumail was following his imam, right? He was following his imam. That's a very important point. You know, that it stays with them, basically. So Imam Ali puts his head down, and then he starts to, after a while, he tells Kumail some important things. And then he tells Kumail, "Oh, Kumail, do you know what? Do you know you should always go towards knowledge and not towards money? Do you know why? Because if you gather loads of money, you have to try and protect it all the time so it doesn't get lost or some thieves don't come and take your money. You constantly try to protect your money. But if you get loads of knowledge, knowledge would protect you. It will always keep you safe because if you know a lot, you won't make mistakes because you know where the mistakes are. You have a lot of knowledge." Wow, that's beautiful. Kumail really appreciated that. He thought that was very nice, that I should always try and get a lot of knowledge. And to get money is not so important because if I get loads and loads of money, I'll just have to be busy trying to keep it safe. While if I try and get loads of knowledge, knowledge will keep me safe. Right, so I'll stop over here. You can carry on the story, but safety is one thing that children really appreciate. It's a very key word, especially if you have children that kind of perhaps might have, they're young, for example, they're scared of certain things, or even a bit older, they don't have that much confidence. The moment you tell them this, it's a very strong motivation, right? Because now they feel safe, right? They understand the importance of knowledge. And you don't have to mention anything, right? I don't have to mention about the lessons that they learned from the story, nothing. And you can end the story however you want to end it, or we can end it together if you want. And that's it. And that's the story.
You're doing a very great job narrating that story, especially that your audience is this 30-year-old bearded man. It's a fantastic way. I'm wondering here, for some of our audience, they might feel shy to speak like that or to behave in a way that children actually enjoy it. Any messages for them?
You have to come out of it. There's nothing you can do about it. Just come out of it. Take a deep breath and say, you know what? It's just your kids at the end of the day, right? Nobody else is listening to it. You might find out there online, for example, recorded stories as well. But it's always best that it comes from the parents. So just take all the shyness out of it. Nobody's going to laugh at you. It's just your own kids. And they're going to love it. Don't worry.
And the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt did it as well. And we're not superior to them.
Exactly.
All right, let's take a break. After the break, we'll be back with some more questions about the storytelling.
Ya Muqiyal Khayrat, Ya Muqiyal Khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. So we've been speaking about storytelling to children with the intention to introduce the Ahlul Bayt as their role model for a few episodes. And today, Brother Mighdad did an excellent job in giving us a sample of how to tell stories. Now we're elaborating on this and discussing how the story was told. It's a very, very nice idea to tell the story and then ask about it. So one question that the parents here may have, Brother Mighdad, is that in this story, some time in the dark at midnight, Imam Ali comes, takes Kumail outside in the desert, and he tells them in the desert that if you gather wealth, you have to protect it, but if you gather knowledge, it protects you. And parents might ask that, well, in such a scenario, my child might ask me, why didn't you just tell it in the mosque, and why did it have to be midnight? It could have been in the morning. How do you respond to these questions by children?
So first of all, I don't think children would ask that. Children don't analyze in such a way that they try and kind of criticize an imam's action. It's adults that do that, trying to question, why did Imam Ali do it like this, right? This is not something that children would usually do. Number one. Number two is that the hadith I mentioned, so obviously this is from a hadith, right? It's a part of a hadith, right? So Amir al-Mu'minin, when he takes Kumail out in the desert, so it's in the hadith, right? Amir al-Mu'minin grabs Kumail's hand, Kumail narrates himself, so Amir al-Mu'minin came to me, grabbed my hand, took me to the desert, and says, we would all to the desert. Then he put his head down. Then he lifted his head and then said things to me. And then Imam Ali mentioned a lot of things, right? It's a whole page long hadith, basically. I just took one part of it and mentioned it. So we're not inventing things, right? But I did make the prelude to the story quite big, right? I mean, if I were to mention this hadith from the member, for example, in the mosque, I would say that Amir al-Mu'minin told Kumail this and in one sentence, right? But obviously, we want to make a story out of it at the end of the day. You want to allow the children to really be part of the story, right? And if you don't do this, then if I come to the children and say, by the way, did you know, children, that Amir al-Mu'minin one day told Kumail that if you take money, you have to protect it. And if you take more knowledge, then knowledge will protect you. You won't get the same effect, right? I mean, the effect that you had when I told you that story with all the movement, all the voice, everything is completely different than just mentioning that. So you have to make the story big. You have to add details to the story, make it more real, basically. And this is when the message gets through, and this is when you really interact and feel part of the story, right? You feel that you were there when Amir al-Mu'minin said that, and you thought suddenly it wasn't talking to Kumail anymore, it was talking to you. Right, you feel that, so you need all of that to be there. So the answer to the parents is that don't worry, children won't ask you the why damn you don't want to take Kumail to the desert. Actually, they really so much enjoyed that it's not like I'm not going to ask why you did that.
Yeah, they just forget all about the whole mosque thing.
It's quite fun, right? Yeah.
Thank you very much. It was a wonderful show, Brother Maghdad. I hope our audience enjoyed it as well. If you missed it, no worries. You can always download an archive of this episode and previous ones from our website. Simply visit www.parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com, and find us on the Call of Islam page. You can also email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode and a lot of storytelling, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be covering Iran's response to Israel's murderous missile assault on the Iranian consulate in Damascus earlier this month. The corporate media once again failed in its duty to report accurately about Israel and typically resorted to simply parroting Israel's version of events. But contrary to what Western political leaders and media commentators have said, Iran's drone and missile strike, codenamed Operation True Promise, did achieve its objective, as Latifa Abu Chaka will explain in this report.
In what CNN reported was the largest drone attack in world history, the Islamic Republic of Iran struck at the Zionist entity on Saturday, the 13th of April. It was in response to the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, carried out a fortnight before. CNN also noted it was an operation which seemed planned to minimize casualties, in stark contrast to the previous 6 months of the Zionist genocide in Gaza. According to the Zionists, the operation was ineffective in that 99% of the drones and missiles launched were intercepted. But, of course, as the experience of the resistance axes shows, the most efficient way to defeat the Iron Dome system is to overwhelm and confuse it. In addition, however, it is plain that the missiles which did strike home, in particular at the Nevatim airbase in the Naqab Desert, caused significant damage to the base F-35 aircraft departed from here to bomb the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Western media are very reluctant to even mention the other major target, an intelligence base for Israeli military intelligence known as Unit 8200. The Zionists tried their best to suppress all mention of the attack on the top secret base, which, as the Israeli press has previously noted, is the first line of defense in preventing surprise attacks, and is an outpost that has been labeled the eyes of the nation. The chief of staff of the Iranian armed forces, Major General Mohammad Baghari, noted that the operation against Iran in Damascus was directed from here. The outpost is located literally inside the mountain in tunnels dug in the 1980s in the illegally occupied Golan Heights. It's not only the Palestinian resistance that has tunnels. The Islamic Republic quoted the right to self-defense, Article 51 of the UN Charter. The Russian Foreign Ministry cited Article 51 in its own response, failing to accede to Zionist demands to condemn Iran. China too did not condemn Iran, calling its response restrained. Though it was condemned by the West, some Western figures conceded its legitimacy, albeit grudgingly. British Foreign Secretary David Cameron was asked what the UK government would do if a hostile nation flattened one of Britain's consulates. He answered, "We would take very strong action."
What would Britain do if a hostile nation flattened one of our consulates?
Well, we would take, you know, we would take the very strong action.
He also appeared to simply take issue with the proportionality of the strike.
Countries have a right to respond when they feel they've suffered an aggression. Of course they do.
Operation True Promise was the first direct military strike on Israel by the Islamic Republic. It's unlikely to be the last. It utilized a tiny fraction of the available armaments, and it showed that it can successfully penetrate the much vaunted air defense systems of the Zionist entity.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's now a senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. And joining us once again as our guest commentator is Batul Sabeti. Batul is a human rights activist and political analyst. She blogs at Stances to Salvation, and in her professional life, she's a chemical engineer based in London. Welcome to the show. Batul, you've already written, haven't you, about Operation True Promise, and you've argued that Iran is trying to actually avoid a regional war. Just set out what your rationale is for arguing that point.
Right. Iran has never wanted war. It's Israel that's consistently transgressed through its assassinations, its cyber attacks, prodding terrorist bombings inside Iran. Israel was not expecting Iran to respond in this way, though. But ultimately, Iran proved that it's a new era. The time for Israel to hit Iranian generals without facing direct consequences is long gone, and Iranian sovereignty is ultimately that red line. The Iranian strategy of response, though, is based on Gaza remaining the focus. To turn it ultimately into a regional conflict is giving Israel what it wants, because that would free Israel's hand in Gaza, as the world will be distracted away from their mass genocide. And that would ultimately facilitate Israel's only plan for Gaza, which is to create unbearable conditions to get rid of Gaza altogether. So the Iranian response comes with what serves the strategy of Gaza remaining under the microscope, and not what serves its enemy strategy, because Israel's always wanted America to fight Iran on its behalf, because Iran represents an existential threat to it. So what Iran wants to do is it wants to halt the Israeli war on Gaza. It considers this to be the greatest victory because the war would have ended with the Gazan resistance standing strong. But at the same time, Iran has also sent a direct message. And that is, if we want to respond in a strong manner, it will be something else. And if Israel is stupid enough to escalate, Iran will make it much worse.
Right. Well, from a military perspective, then, David, I mean, in your opinion, how effective was Iran's actions in this occasion?
Well, the question of what military success is something which, of course, is part of the debate. So, of course, the Zionists said 99% of these missiles were downed. Now, that might actually be true, startlingly enough. But the question is not whether they downed all these drones which were sent deliberately in order to fox the Iron Dome system and to distract it from the really serious missiles which did hit their targets, the hypersonic missiles which were sent over by Iran. It takes 12 minutes to get there. So those hit their targets. But some people have said, well, it didn't put the base out of operation. The science has been saying that as well. Well, the point of an operation like this is not to put the base out of operation, not to destroy the Zionist entity's defences, but to show that at will, they can do that. And that in the future, that will be exactly what will happen. Mm. And there can be no doubt. So the Zionists might say, oh, well, it was terribly unsuccessful, that the Iranians can't even do anything right. But actually, they